Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Tierney ou le grand pont pour éliminer Furlong. Qu'est-ce qu'il lui a fait là? Qu'est-ce qu'il lui fait, Kieran Tierney? Kieran Tierney, c'est quoi? C'est quoi ça? Il vient souhaiter une très bonne année aux supporters d'Arsenal. Kieran Tierney, quel rush! Magnifique! Magnifique!
This is Arsecast Extra.
Hello and welcome to another Arsecast Extra, as always, with James from Gunnerblog. James, good morning to you.
Good morning, Andrew. How are you?
I'm all right. You know what I discovered at the weekend? I heard about this amazing thing called Arsenal Football Club. That apparently it's a...
Doesn't ring any bells.
...group of people that get together and play football, and people watch and follow from near and far.
Sounds nice.
Yeah,
Is it nice?
I think so. I mean, I can't think of anything that could be wrong with it, but I'm interested to give it a try. Yeah, there must be a catch. Sounds too good to be true, doesn't it?
Well, let's give it a whirl, Andrew. From what I understand, there is an opportunity for us to engage in this particular pastime, commencing on Thursday and running as far as May. Have you got any plans particularly in that period?
No. I mean, I was thinking of taking up, you know, some hobbies, but you know, this sounds like it might be better than any of the ones I was thinking of anyway. That's
I would say allow this to fill every conceivable void in your life for the next several months,
right?
And dramatically affect and influence your emotional state. Do you feel up for that?
I reckon I could. There's something missing, that is for sure, and this could very well fill that gap. You know, the way we talk about a mid-season break, and they have talked about it for years, and they do it in the Bundesliga and they do it in other leagues and everything else. And you know, we always said this would be great for the players to have a break, wouldn't it be really good for them, and you know, for their injuries. We ask a lot of footballers these days, fuck footballers, get them back on that pitch and never have another break again. I'm feeling very itchy and antsy towards football right now. I'm missing it more than I thought I would.
Sure. I mean, I guess had we still been in the FA Cup, we might have had a slightly less of a break. But yeah, it is odd, the winter break. It's sort of crept into the schedule without too much fanfare. You know, it's something that people were so agitated about in press conferences for years and years and years. And now it has kind of appeared over the last couple of years in there. And yet it doesn't seem to have merited that much discussion. I think it's undoubtedly a good thing for the players, but it does leave us scrabbling around a bit for entertainment for a fortnight or so.
That's true. And I retract my fuck footballers comment from just a few minutes ago. I was just feeling a little bit emotional about, you know, all the nothing that we've had to contend with over the last couple of weeks. So how have you been filling the nothingness yourself?
Great question. I can't really think. I went fishing at the weekend. Norfolk.
Did you stand in water? Did you do the thing?
No, I stood near water. There was a lot of debate about what am I allowed to do? Am I allowed on boats? No. Am I allowed on piers?
Yeah.
Not really.
You're not allowed on a pier.
Things that move in water. It depends how solid the pier is. I can walk on a solid pier, but I guess I mean more like decking.
Yeah.
But I fished from the shore.
Okay.
And thoroughly enjoyed it. I mean, I don't know what I'm doing, let's be clear. Things with like hooks that blow in the wind near faces and eyes. I shouldn't really be allowed to do that, but I survived it. All the fish survived it. It was a fairly humane operation.
You weren't fishing for food, like some kind of wilderness man.
Purely for sport. Purely to torment the fish, I guess.
Right.
No, I was eating well enough on shore.
I always feel like that's, you know, look, I'm a meat eater and all that kind of stuff, but I always kind of feel like, well, I just fish and then I catch the fish and then I throw it back and it's fine. But the fish is going around going, fuck, my fucking mouth is killing me. Fuck's sake. Why didn't they just do me in and put me out of my misery, you fuckers? And now you throw me back into the water. I can't even eat. Can't have any plankton or whatever the fuck it is fish eat. What do fish eat?
Well, some fish eat other fish.
Yeah. Bastard cannibals.
Some fish, it turns out, eat maggots or worms, I've learnt this weekend.
Right.
Yeah. Basically, whatever you drop in the water for them. But, yeah, I did sort of puzzle over that aspect of it. I did some like research around fish survival rates post catch. They're generally pretty good, I have to say. But you know, the psychological trauma must be significant.
Yeah, everyone calling you old. Oh, look, there's old hook mouth again. Look at him going around, lisping, can't even talk properly to all the other fish. What about the fishing where you stand in the water? You know, that kind of, it's very bucolic looking. Yeah, you put on the giant, you know, wellies and, you know, overalls and what have you, and you stand there in the river, sun glistening at your back, and you cast your line, and you just stand there at one with...
That would be nice. But bear in mind, I was in Norfolk in early February, and essentially there was a hurricane happening. I mean, it was incredibly cold and windy.
Right.
I think the actual temperature was about 6 degrees, but because of the wind blowing in from the ocean, it felt it felt about -3. So cold as I was, I never thought, do you know what would improve this? Submerging myself.
Yeah.
But no, I did enjoy it. It was a good experience. What have you been doing? Playing golf, I imagine, judging by the blog you wrote the other day.
Yeah, doing a bit of golf and cooking food and things like that. So, yeah, nothing too exciting, unfortunately. But I'm pledging to play more golf and, you know, watch more of this football stuff and everything else. I watched some films over the weekend, but I won't say, I won't spoil any for anyone because I've got some thoughts on the films. But nobody's here for my film reviews.
We'll come back in a year when everyone's seen the films.
Exactly. And I'll say, God, the way that film ended was really terrible or what have you.
You'll say, I told you so.
Did
you watch any of the FA Cup action?
I did not.
No.
I believe your local club.
My hometown club, Boreham Wood.
Yeah. Wow.
Into the fifth round.
Wow. Fifth round. That's amazing, isn't it?
It is kind of amazing. I mean, they're playing in the non-league, which is a bit of an outdated term, non-league, because, you know, they are a professional operation.
And it is a league.
And it is a league. It's the National League. But, you know, they're in the fifth tier, sort of pushing for promotion playoff places.
Yeah.
But, yeah, they beat MK Dons, I think it was. Or was it AFC Wimbledon? Maybe it was AFC Wimbledon in the previous round. And then they went away to promotion-chasing Bournemouth in the championship and won 1-0 yesterday.
That is pretty impressive stuff, isn't it?
It is. I mean, Bournemouth at one point in the game had Todd Cantwell on the field and who's the guy they signed from Celtic? I remember thinking there are three players on the pitch who I remember being linked with Arsenal.
Right.
One was Todd Cantwell. One was Freddie Woodman, the goalkeeper, who they've just signed on loan from Newcastle. And one was Ryan Christie, who I think is the ex-Celtic midfielder.
Yeah, we were linked with him at some point, I remember.
Yeah, and I was thinking, oh, wow, this is like the Arsenal nearly 11. And they lost to Boreham Wood. So, yeah, that was quite extraordinary. And my sister and her husband went. They took my niece to her first ever football game. Hopefully she will. I don't know if she will remember it. She's only three. But if she does, it's a good one to remember.
Well, yeah. Yeah, but I mean, they might have set the expectations too high now.
That's true. I mean, Goodison Park away in the next round. On a midweek fixture. The fifth round is midweek. That doesn't seem right to me. But yeah, I mean, I guess she'll be in there at Goodison Park. She'll have to be now. She's a lucky totem.
Yeah. Hang on. Is that...
Late night for a three-year-old, but what can you do?
Well, yeah, if they don't win, you know, she's going to set up her own YouTube channel, do some On The Whistle, going crazy.
Yeah, that's true. Bournemouth fan... Bournemouth manager. Fan TV.
Yeah, yeah. That'll be fun.
I mean, I'm... you know...
Oh, there's
I'm
my door.
That she's had a positive experience. Oh, you better get the doorbell. Hang on. It's an excuse to have the doorbell music.
It is. Hang on.
What was it, Andrew?
What was it? It was the postman who was in the middle of eating a sandwich, which was quite weird. I opened the door and he went, sorry, I'm just stuffing my face here. And then he gave me a package.
Was it all greasy?
No.
The sandwich?
No. It was a tightly wrapped package, which I believe is a dog bed, which I ordered off the internet some time ago.
I see.
And it's just arrived.
You've grown tired of human beds.
Exactly.
You've been eyeing up your own dog's beds, you know, for so long. They look so comfy.
Yeah, they look so comfy in there. Now, I got one of these dog beds that's, it sort of envelops the dog, if you know
sure,
what I mean.
Sure.
So.
Yeah. Oh, is it one that they sort of sink into?
Kind of, yeah. But it's obviously got to be big for German Shepherds.
Yeah, I've seen them.
Yeah.
I've seen them.
So
they
we'll
do
see.
Look comfy.
They do. They do. I'll report back as to comfort levels when I see either Archer or Lana in it later on. There may be, you know, some issues because I only got one of them. There are a number of dog beds around the house, but I only got one of these to see what it would be like. I may have to get another one, but we'll see. They won't fight over it, I'm sure.
We'll see.
Let's do this because we, you know, we have questions and we have questions that we normally do in part two of a show. But normally part one of a show is when we talk about, you know, the stuff that's happened.
Games
and pre-games and previews and reviews and transfers and all of that kind of
selling
stuff.
Selling players, not buying players.
Yeah, letting players go for free, all of that kind of stuff. There hasn't been any of that. There's certainly been no more of it than I want to discuss, or that hasn't been discussed at length already on all the various podcasts of late. So let's do a few questions throughout the show.
Okay.
And we'll start with this one from KB. On Twitter, who is at MFWB17. And he says, how excited are you? It almost feels to me like the start of a new season in terms of anticipation. We've 17 games to go with a very likable, improving squad that most fans can get behind and a very clear goal in mind. Let's get it done, lads. I think he's talking to us about the question, not Arsenal winning games,
sure.
I'm pretty sure.
How excited am I? I definitely feel sort of re-energised, I guess, as we've kind of been alluding to in this pod about the resumption of football. I'm going to Wolves as a fan on Thursday. I'll be in the away end. Not a great omen, that, historically, but...
Well, maybe someone will,
to it.
You know, clatter you over the head with an iron bar or something.
That could happen, actually. If you're sat, if you're stood in the row behind me... Just one big whack over the back of the head.
Yeah.
That should be enough to secure the three points. I am looking forward to it, but I have to be honest and say there's some trepidation on my side. You know, this is the sort of more stressful half of the season, given how high the stakes become. You know, every point dropped at this point, I think, feels like it carries more weight than one dropped in, say, October. And because the table is kind of semi-formulated at this point, the sort of jumping of places or dropping of places brings with it a kind of emotional roller coaster that I am bracing myself for. How excited are you?
I am. I'm kind of excited if we have everybody fit. You know what I mean? I share the trepidation. I think everybody does. you know, because we have been through a January where all the focus was on what we were going to do in the transfer market. We didn't do anything. So nobody's feeling like extra confident. You know what I mean? We haven't had that bit of extra confidence boost or the idea that when we start again, we're going to see a shiny new player in an Arsenal shirt, you know, someone who might have added some depth or whatever to the forward positions. Nevertheless, you know, when I think about, I did a piece today on the blog about, you know, what we have and the players we have and how confident I feel in them. And I, you know, going through it, felt confident with our goalkeepers, confident with our first choice defenders, although slightly trepidatious about some of the backup options that we have, or maybe even lack of the backup options. Even in midfield, I think if Partey and Xhaka stay fit, it's a decent partnership. It's, you know, one I think that we could improve on, but we can't really with what we've got at this moment in time. I really like the collection of attacking midfielders and wide forwards that we have. And I'm worried about striker, as I think everybody is. You know, if we're looking for goals from our strikers, that's certainly a bit of a worry. But if it stays together and if we can, you know, get going again, get a couple of good results under our belts, and this tight group of players can stay together, stay fit, I am kind of excited about what we might be able to do. I'm worried, of course, that, you know, we might not be able to do it. And if we miss out by, you know, a little bit, does that then drag up all the, you know, the stuff about January again, which I'm sure it will. But at this point, you know, I just want to see them get out there and I hope they come back and have come back from Dubai fit and healthy and rested and little aches and strains that they've been carrying into the, you know, into the break, you know, will be by the wayside and they can be, you know, just ready to go again. So on that basis, I am quite excited, I have to say.
Yeah, there are definitely things I'm excited about. I'm excited about seeing, you know, what Bukayo Saka and Emile Smith Rowe look like after some much needed time off. I'm excited about what Martinelli might be able to do in the second half of this season. It feels like he has been the major beneficiary of Aubameyang going. I mean, his ascendancy has kind of coincided with Aubameyang coming out of the team, and I don't think that's pure coincidence. I think there is a kind of significance to that sort of tactically. I'm excited about getting some midfielders back and available. I think we really had to muddle through in that part of the pitch in January, and it was, or we failed to muddle through, I think, in some instances. Yeah, and, you know, this is a group of players that I do, for the most part, really like, feel very positive about. So I'm looking forward to seeing them play again. I think it's quite a tough start, to be honest. Wolves away on Thursday.
Yeah.
I don't think that's the easiest fixture to come back to, and it's one that could have significant permutations in the table. I think if they beat us, they would go above us, which wouldn't feel too good. But, yeah, it's interesting, this kind of mid-season break. It does feel like a bit of a reset point. I keep coming back to this, but I do think that I hope it will have been very valuable to the players. I do think that we saw some performances in January that looked a bit leggy, a bit fatigued, even mentally so. And just seeing the little clips and pictures from Dubai, I think that change of scene, and for them as much as anything, just sort of wiping the slate clean almost and just focusing on the task ahead, I think that could be really helpful.
Yeah, I agree. And I watched an interview with Jack Wilshere. It was on TalkSport, but it was doing the rounds on Twitter and stuff. And it was quite interesting. He talked really well, I thought, about, you know, what they did and what the work they were doing out there was. And he said there was quite a lot of fitness work as well as, you know, the other bits and pieces that they had some time off. But yeah, I was interested to hear as well Mikel Arteta talk about the what he felt was the benefit of the trip was, you know, to get people together and to foster a bit of team spirit. And it's one of those where I know people differ in terms of how important they think those things are and how, I mean, we can't measure them. There is no sort of metric or X team spirit that Opta can give us, you know, but they are important. And I do wonder if part of Arteta's outlook is to make sure that this his team or his groups of players are as unified as possible, as a way to try and sort of achieve some kind of marginal gain on the teams, you know, above us, like Man City and Chelsea, who are ultra rich, Liverpool, who are much more developed and mature. You know, any little thing that he can wring out of these group of players. I mean, there's, you know, obviously the quality of players is the most important thing. But if you do have a collective, if you do have guys who are willing to go, you know, that extra inch that, you know, for each other in games, it can make a difference. It can make a difference, even if we can't measure it.
Yeah, and I think it is clear that there is quite a positive feeling among the group. It's interesting, you know, we always sort of sit on the sidelines and dissect it and wonder about relationships and does so and so look happy. And then when you watch the training pictures, you're like, well, they do seem to be sort of largely enjoying their lives. I think sometimes we are guilty as fans of kind of over worrying about some of that stuff. And I also think that we exist in a world of sort of online discourse around Arsenal, which hasn't been entirely positive in the last few weeks. But one thing that I think is quite helpful for the players is they've literally been on another continent, probably quite insulated from that. You know, while everybody was talking about transfers, these players were in Dubai on essentially a kind of holiday training camp, having a good time. And I do wonder, you know, I do think that that provides them sort of a measure of kind of protection from some of that angst. And I think that could be really helpful. Like, there's a unity and a clarity of purpose now that has to propel us through the next 17 games. And it's going to be very interesting. I think the stakes will feel very, very high. People talk about sort of kind of 17 cup finals. I do think it may have that feel, just because we're not fighting on multiple fronts. So the focus is going to be quite intense. The magnifying glass is really on these league fixtures.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's it. You do approach it that way, you know. 17 cup finals is quite stressful, in fairness, though.
Exactly, yeah. And some of them are against, you know, Spurs and Chelsea and
Liverpool. There's some big games, all right. Yeah, that's for sure. Let me see if I've got another one. Here's an interesting one, actually, from The Chief, who's at macho_grande1. And he said, a question for next week's pod before I forget. Oh, he said it the other day and he's reminding me of it today. Okay, so he says, signing one striker is challenging. Signing two is incredibly difficult. Signing three is basically impossible. So what are the chances one or both of Lacazette and Kedia stay? And should we make it a priority to keep at least one?
It's a good question, that. I do think that as soon as it became clear Aubameyang was on the way out, and whether that happened in January or in the summer, I think the chances of one or certainly one of those two players, Lacazette or Nketiah, staying increased. I mean, Eddie Nketiah is a really interesting case. I mean, I will come back to that question, but Highbury Lover on Twitter said, Arteta's always believed more in Eddie than fans have. Does getting rid of Oba and not signing a replacement and rejecting bids for Eddie indicate Arteta is indeed looking to give him more game time and eventually time to a new contract? Eddie is probably the only person associated with Arsenal who was glad that they didn't sign a striker in January. He is the person who, I guess, stands to benefit most from that, and has what you'd have to say is an unbelievable opportunity to make a name for himself in the Premier League and earn himself a contract somewhere. I'm not, in answer to the question, convinced that he's suddenly going to be starting games because he has stuck around and Oba hasn't. I think that the reason we've kept him is clearly security. You know, just it would be unthinkable to only have Lacazette as a recognised striker. I don't think selling him was really an option in January if Aubameyang was going to go. And I still think that it would take quite a dramatic change in circumstances for him to end up signing a new Arsenal contract. I think he would have to contribute so significantly that he felt that he was going into next season genuinely competing for a first team place. And I'm not sure I see that happening. Like, I don't think he would sign a new contract to be third choice again next season.
No. No.
So he would have to have such a good few months that he felt that the contract would reflect the fact that he was going to be, you know, taken more seriously in Arteta's thoughts next year.
I mean, would a good few months like that, though, not make a move somewhere else much more likely, given the fact that he's out of contract in the summer? So let's say Eddie Nketiah, and I don't believe this will happen, but if he scored 8 goals in the Premier League between now and the end of the season, like, it might improve the offer that he gets from Arsenal, but it's more than likely going to make other clubs sit up and say, hey, this guy's free. And we may pay Arsenal like a little bit of a tribunal fee, you know.
Yeah, but we might get a better tribunal fee if he does well. But yeah, I think that's, you're probably right. You know, Newcastle, I don't think, did bid for Eddie in January. I think it was Crystal Palace. But, you know, just if you pluck a Newcastle, for example, and say, you know, they bought Joe Willock. If Eddie has a decent little stretch here and they come in with a big contract for him, you know, then he's more likely to go there, I think, than stay as a backup player at Arsenal. So I find it hard to foresee a situation where he remains at the club, just because I think even if it goes well, I don't necessarily see it making sense. I do think it's a good thing that he needs it to go well. I mean, you know, he must be highly motivated at this point. Lacazette, the Lyon owner came out, didn't he, during the break and said, we're in touch with him, as he has every right to be. I think from January 1st, Lacazette can sign a new deal somewhere else. If it's outside the UK or outside England. I think that he probably will go. I just think that Arsenal aren't going to offer him the length of deal that will give him the security at this point in his career. What do you think on those two?
I mean, I agree with you on the Eddie thing. I think he wants to go and play somewhere. And like I said, even if it goes really well, I think it just increases the chances that he'll leave because he'll get a good contract somewhere else. He's got, you know, he's what, 20, 22 now?
He's actually 34 now, Eddie Nketiah. It creeps up on you.
It does. Oh, my goodness.
He's 22.
22. So, yeah, he's going to be 23 by the end of the season. May 30th, he'll be 23 years of age. And I
like that, by the way, when players turn age between seasons. It's really helpful.
Yeah.
Or I like Jack Wilshere was born on January 1st. That, again, was helpful. You could easily work it out. I don't like these sort of sneaky October birthdays that you miss and then you accidentally call someone the wrong age.
You sign a 19-year-old and you're thinking, what a teenage whiz kid we've got. And then, like, in October, he's not anymore. It's like Trades Description Act. So I think probably this summer, for a guy who's at 23 years of age and, you know, is at a point in his career where I think he just will want to play regular football. And I don't think he's ever going to be a first-choice striker at Arsenal, so why wouldn't he go somewhere else where he's, you know, in an environment where his chances of first-team football are increased? That's what I think will happen with him. Lacazette, like, I don't think there's ever been an intention to give him a new contract, which is why we are where we are with him. But the Aubameyang thing, we weren't expecting to lose him this year. We weren't expecting him to go next year either, I don't think. So, yeah, again, it comes down to what else he's got available to him as an offer. Like, if we're offering him a 1+1 deal and Lyon come in with a 3-year deal, maybe 3+1, something like that, like, we don't have any chance of keeping him, even if we wanted to. He would go, you know, he would go somewhere else, I think, because the length of contract that you get when you're a 30-year-old is an important aspect of your decision-making, right? Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't be at all surprised if Arsenal tried to keep him, but I don't know that we'd be able to.
Yeah, I think they'll make him an offer. The way things are going, I think they'll make him an offer, but I don't know if it'll be one that he would be inclined to take. And I think the upshot of that is that, going back to the original question, I think it's highly likely that Arsenal may need to look at more than one forward in the summer.
Mm.
You know, unless Martinelli gets a run through the middle and it begins to become clear that that might be his future, or unless Balogun absolutely explodes at Middlesbrough and looks like he's ready to come back into the first team squad, I really think it's possible that we could be looking at requiring two strikers rather than just one.
Okay, well, on the Discord, Naef says, "Morning, gents. Do you really believe we are going to go for Dominic Calvert-Lewin?" He wrote DCL, and for a second I couldn't figure out what the hell DCL was. "And Isaac in the summer. And would that be an elite strike force?" And you know, these are just based on, you know, what I think have been publicly reported as targets for Arsenal. Players that Arsenal certainly are interested in. But, you know, would that be a good summer for you, Calvert-Lewin and Alexander Isaac?
Well, I mean, first of all, I've reported that Isaac, Vlahovic and Calvert-Lewin were the top three targets in January. And I can say that with some conviction. I'm very convinced of that. Obviously, between now and the summer, somebody might emerge or that list might shift or alter. But all indications are that those two names will be in contention again come the next transfer window. I mean, there are question marks over both.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so Calvert-Lewin has barely played this season. Missed basically the entirety of the first half of the season. Hasn't really come back yet to anything like any sort of form. Isaac, his goal scoring has dropped off this year. You know, he's not been hugely productive in Spain with Sociedad.
Mm.
Equally, it's not like there are a ton of other names, you know, that you immediately say, well, it should be them. You know, I know Jonathan David's having an excellent season in France with Lille. So that would be one, I think, maybe to consider. But it's not easy to identify, you know, if we accept that Arsenal aren't going to be able to sign Erling Haaland, for example.
I think I can accept that, yes.
I think
I've already accepted that.
I think I very much accept that. We do get quite a lot of questions, don't we, sort of saying, why couldn't Arsenal sign Haaland? I think the bigger question is, why would Haaland choose Arsenal at this point?
Yeah.
You know, he's playing in the Champions League. Yeah, I think it's not the logical next step for him in his career. Dominic Calvert-Lewin and Isaac have different strengths and weaknesses, and I think there are different people within the club who are in favour of either. Mm. I think with Isaac, what they like is his pressing game. He's quite good off the ball. He's good at dropping into midfield, linking things up, very technically strong. With Calvert-Lewin, he's more of a physical presence. He has a decent, actually, goal-scoring record in the Premier League already. I think last season he was pretty effective in front of goal, 16 goals, something like that.
Mm.
And they're both at an age, particularly Isaac, where they could kick on a gear. You know, and I think Calvert-Lewin too, even though he's sort of coming up to mid-20s, when you think about that type of centre-forward, the sort of archetypal target man, it is often post 24, post 25 that they really explode. You know, I mean, certainly that was the case for someone like Didier Drogba. Harry Kane, I think, was a little bit later on when he really began to flourish. Olivier Giroud, who we saw at Arsenal, was kind of a bit of a journeyman in the early 20s and still going strong at AC Milan, I noticed this weekend.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think we, I guess I say with some hesitation, we have to trust that if they plump for one of those guys, they believe the fit will be right. But it's a hugely important signing, and one that, if it just doesn't work at all, will be a millstone around the club's neck, because neither of these guys would come cheap. What do you think of those two?
I mean, I would take them now, of course.
Sure.
You know, we're a sort of beggars can't be choosers scenario when it comes to strikers. I'm really fascinated to see what they do in the summer in this position, because, you know, in the five transfer windows that Mikel Arteta has had, he's never bought a forward. You know, I suppose you could include Willian as a forward, but not really. He hasn't had to, because he's had Aubameyang, he's had Lacazette, he's had Nketiah, he's had, you know, players at the club. So there hasn't necessarily been space. So I'm really interested to see, you know, what he does when he does buy a striker and what kind of profile he's looking for. Because I think there might be a sense out there that whoever it is could be like the final piece of the jigsaw, if you like, of his, you know, his first team that he's put together, because this is now pretty much a team in his own image. When you look at the defenders, when you look at the midfielders, I know there are some players that he's inherited, but, you know, pretty much anyone he doesn't want, you know, is no longer here, to varying degrees of ruthlessness, right? So this is pretty much a team in his image beyond the center forward that he might like, you know, or that he feels would be the right fit for his team. So I'm really interested, whether it's Isaac or whether it's Calvert-Lewin or somebody else that we don't quite know. You know, this purchase come the summer will be the one that might well define the success that, you know, he has at this football club. Because once you do get all the bits, once you do get all the pieces, and this is, of course, being... how do I say this? I mean, not every manager gets everything they want. You know what I mean? They have to deal with what they have, and they have to work with what they have. And the, you know, the idea that you can only be judged until you get every single player that you want in every single position is, you know, that's a bit crazy. I accept that. But I do think that we've gone so far down the road with this project that that's probably the outcome that we're going to see for Arteta, you know, unless it goes really badly wrong in these 17 games. I think whatever happens, you know, they're planning for the summer, and that's the next thing that they're gonna do is bring in a striker. So, yeah, I'm really interested. I don't know who it's going to be, but, like, at this point, of course, I would take any of them. Can I ask you another question? Yash, yeah. Bisht, who's at Yarsnal09, says, should we consider bringing in a winger? Pepe and Nelson seem to have run their races, while we only have two natural wingers in Martinelli and Saka. If we get Europe next season, it isn't ideal. And then he says we should keep one eye on Gnabry due to his contractual situation. And there was another question on the Discord that mentioned Serge Gnabry. If I can find it, which I can't, and I apologize to whoever it was that asked it. But I don't know, is Gnabry's contract up in the summer, or is it 1 year to go, whatever it might be?
I'll have a look now. It looks like 1 year to go,
right,
in the summer. I mean, again, forgive me, but I just don't see that happening.
No, again, me neither, but...
Again, why would you leave Bayern Munich to come play Arsenal? And listen, I would. I love Arsenal, but I'm not sure Serge Gnabry...
He probably feels like he's got unfinished business.
Unfinished business,
you know what I mean? It's gnawing away at the back of his mind. He's thinking, here I am in Germany, in the Bundesliga, in Munich, winning every game, you know, going far in the Champions League, playing for Germany, but, you know, it's not what I really want. I want to go back and fix that situation that I had at Arsenal. It didn't work out.
He's yearning. He's yearning for those 0-0 draws.
He's a July birthday as well.
Do it now. Move mountains. Get him in. Whatever the cost. A wide player. I think it's very possible we will be looking at a wide player. I mean, but it's not an area where we're short of numbers. You know, Saka, Smith Rowe, Martinelli, Pepe, who's a sort of a conversation topic unto himself. I think Reece Nelson, I'd be very surprised if he comes back into the Arsenal squad. He's had quite a difficult loan thus far, and I hope it turns around for him and he's able to make more of an impact. I thought it would be a really good move going to Holland, but it's just not caught light at all.
There were some interesting comments, weren't there, from the manager about, you know, the end product. Side. Yeah, the tactical side of the game.
He's basically saying he had a bit to learn, which I guess is natural, but nothing he's shown there suggests he's going to be pushing for a place back in the Arsenal first team. I do think Amari Hutchinson looks a really interesting young player.
Ooh, doesn't he just? The goal
Fantastic
he scored
goal
at the weekend. Yeah, wow.
Maybe it would be a bit soon for him. Maybe a loan would come beforehand, but I do think that's a name that will be in contention over the next few years. I think much depends on Pepe. I actually had a question about Pepe. Do you mind if I ask you it? It was from Dazzy Pepper on Discord. And Dazzy said, let's talk about Pepe. Do you expect him to be getting involved regularly and making starts now that AFCON has passed? Or will he continue his run of being an unused substitute? We're going to need goals. And for whatever his flaws, we know he can find the back of the net and create chances.
I hope he's more involved, because I think we have to, with a small squad, we have to manage it smartly and cleverly. We cannot, you know, for example, play Bukayo Saka 17 games in a row, 90 minutes plus injury time every single time as he's getting kicked up and down the pitch by opposition defenders, which is a trademark of what's happened to him this season, because he's good and players know it, so he's getting a bit of treatment. So I think we need to manage him quite carefully, and obviously Pepe is the next option in that position. Mm-hmm. You know, he has been out of the side this season for the most part. He hasn't really contributed. But I think it's important that we get him involved, because we need a little bit of variety. We need to be able to rest players. We need to add something from the bench. You know, when you think about the squad that we have, and when you think about, you know, let's say a starting 11, when that doesn't work, or if it's not successful, or if there are games where it's not going particularly well, the ability to change it from the bench is going to be really, really important. And we don't have, when you look at the squad, a huge amount of depth. You know, there are potentially going to be a lot of young players on the bench. Is it 9 subs you can name now? I think it is, isn't it?
Is it at least 7? Isn't it mad that I don't know? I think it's 7.
Hang on.
We need to check this out.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's 9. I could be wrong. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. It's 9. It's 9.
It's 9.
It's 9.
Wow.
It is 9. So we've seen people talk about, you know, a squad of whatever it is, 17, 18 players. I mean, it is 11 plus 7 gives you 18. That could include a couple of goalkeepers. So potentially there are going to be some young players on the bench just to make up the numbers. But then, you know, if your bench is, let's say, Holding, Cedric, Nuno, Elneny, Nketiah, and then what? You know, maybe one of
Smith-Rowe,
you know, but I want to see him back in the starting 11. And then what have you got? You've got Pepe, and you've got maybe Smith-Rowe, or you've got Martinelli, maybe, or I don't know, depending on who it is that you're starting. There isn't a great deal that you would feel confident about to have an impact as a sub, right?
Mm-hmm.
So on that basis alone, surely Pepe is in contention for quite a few minutes in games where we need a goal, or we need something different, or we need, if you need to, like, do what Arsene Wenger did and throw on all the strikers, you know, he's surely going to be part of that conversation. So I do expect him to be involved, and I hope that there are games where he can start, and we can manage the minutes of some of the other players in order to keep them you know, fresh and ready perhaps for some of the bigger games.
Interesting. See, I think, conversely, I don't think he will get many starts. I just think surely the benefit of us only being in one competition and frequently only playing once a week is that we will be able to largely, if we want, name the same starting 11.
Mm.
And I suspect Arteta will lean into that.
I think that's true. I do think that's true.
But there will be occasions, I guess, where we have midweek games.
Yeah, or you know, what if you know, it's all well and good saying, well, you could start the same 11, but not everybody's going to be at the top of their game for all 17 games. Form will fluctuate. You know, collectively and individually, there are going to be fluctuations in form.
But and there will be injuries as
well. Yeah, injuries and all those things. But you need to be able to, let's say Bukayo Saka doesn't play well for a few games. And maybe the best way to get him back to his best is to, you know, sit him down for a couple of weeks. That's not punishment or anything like that. That's just part of the way football works. And that's where I think Pepe could come in.
I just wonder if Saka's kind of past that point in some ways where he's so important that even if he has two bad games, Arteta will gamble on him playing well in the next. And
what if he has four bad games or five bad games?
That's the magic number. Yeah, of course. Of course it's open.
Yeah.
I'm just saying my instinct is that starting games may be difficult for him to come by.
Mm.
But I really hope he can have an important role within games, and maybe that will be more from the substitutes bench in the way I see things playing out. Because as you say, when you're looking at that bench and you're envisaging who might come on and make a difference or score a goal, I think it's pretty, you know, if one of Martinelli or Smith Rowe doesn't start, then I guess they would be the first name. Mm. But then I think he'd be a very close second in terms of his productivity and his threat. I find it very hard to talk about his long-term future with any great certainty. You know, we've been back and forth so many times on this player. Is he in? Is he out? Is he going to get a new contract? Is he going to leave? But I think he is here now. As far as we're aware, everything's cool. There's no underlying issues that mean he shouldn't play, no disciplinary problems, no exclusion. You know, we're paying him, he's here, we've got to use him. And yeah, I mean, if I was making a sub in a game looking for the breakthrough, I think he might even be the first name for me.
Sure.
In terms of just being someone who can make something happen out of nothing.
Who do you think, just before we go into a break, you know, if we say that there's maybe two places on the bench up for grabs for an under 23 player.
Mm-hmm.
Who do you think are the most likely candidates to be included in the squad?
What's interesting, because a lot of players went out on loan, didn't they, right at the end of January? And I think it's sort of instructive who didn't go.
Mm.
So, obviously, Charlie Patino has been on the bench quite a lot already and has even started in the FA Cup. Amari Hutchinson stuck around, and Mika Beereth as well, the forward.
Mm. Do you think he, as like a centre forward option, might be one of the more likely?
Yeah. The other one is Salah Oladipo, who has had a very good season and midfield option. I think, if I'm honest with you, I think it probably, if it's going to be one, it will be Patino, just because I think they see him as the closest, maybe, in terms of his trajectory and his involvement with the first team and the regularity with which he trains with them. And maybe they see him as the most immediate beneficiary of that experience of being around that environment. But yeah, beyond that, I think maybe Beerus got to have a chance, hasn't he? Just because he is a forward and we're shy of those. And his goal scoring record at academy level, wherever he's been, has been outstanding. He's got to have a shot. But, you know, they might rotate it a bit. I mean, I do think Amari Hutchinson's a really interesting player.
Yeah.
It's just as a kind of, I think I'm right in saying, predominantly left-footed player who comes off the right-hand side a lot, you know, we're already asking how many opportunities Pepe's going to get. So
yeah.
There might be a bit of a pecking order there. What do you fancy?
I mean, just watching Hutchinson's goals and the ability to look. I know it's a different thing at that level, but just that drive that he has. You know, I wonder if in the last 10 minutes of certain games, having somebody like that on your bench might be useful. You know, as a last throw of the dice kind of thing, because you know, our forward options aren't really convincing, but maybe he'll look at it and say, well, I can throw Nketiah on, I can throw Pepe on, and then, you know, he may have one more senior player. But what you can do with substitutes as well is often dictated to by what happens in games as well. You know, you can be forced to use a couple, and whether it's injury or sending off or whatever. And I don't rule out the possibility that Arsenal might have a player or two sent off in these 17 games. Just a crazy idea, I know. All right, let's take a little break. We'll come back with more questions in part two right after this.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact? You can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
It's a brand new year, and what better time to get going with that online store you've been thinking of? Those "I was there when Arsenal actually scored a goal" t-shirts would fly off the shelves right now. And to get yourself up and running, you need Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way through to the did we hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms, and sell more with less effort with thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 a month trial period at shopify.com/arseblog, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/arseblog now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/arseblog. Welcome back to the Arsecast Extra. This is part two of the show where we answer questions that you send to us on what's it called?
Twitter.
Twitter, yeah, at Gunnerblog and at Arseblog, and also on the Arseblog Discord chat server, which you get access to if you're an Arseblog member on Patreon. I should point out it was Wasted Youth AFC who asked the question about Gnabry that I couldn't find, so thank you for that one. Do you want to go first? Because we'll do some more questions.
Yeah, let's do it. Well, Brian Loophole, I really like
Brian
that
Loophole.
On the Discord says, "Goodly morning, gents. How important do you think it is that we get a win against Wolves? With the recent good feeling amongst the fans taking a bit of a hit in January due to the results in the window, I worry that a draw or a loss in that game could create a lot of hostility in the fan base again."
Mm. Brian Loophole. He should be a detective or something, shouldn't he?
Exactly.
Series of detectives.
He's a hotshot lawyer.
Brian Loophole. He always finds a way.
Yeah.
Brian Loophole, this Thursday on NBC. What is the question? Oh, yeah, how important? Of course it's important. I think the fact that, you know, we're coming off a big break and we didn't do the business people wanted us to do in January. It does add a little extra pressure on this one. Like you said earlier, I think it's going to be a tough game. They're all going to be tough games, of course. Mm-hmm. But this will be particularly tough. You know, sometimes you can have a little break and it takes you a game or two to get back and to find your rhythm and that kind of stuff. So,
yeah,
you know, that plus a fairly unconvincing January. You know, there's a lot to be positive about this season, I think. But January, for me anyway, wasn't a particularly positive month. So we have to get going again, and we have to show some of the form that we did in December when we played really well, scored lots of goals, won games convincingly against the kind of opposition that I guess you would put Wolves into the same category as. You know, West Ham. I think they're better than Southampton and Norwich, obviously. I can't remember who the other game was. Leeds. You know, tough, hard-working sides who are going to make it difficult for us, but we coped well in those games. So, yeah, you know, it's all the angst and frustration that we feel about the things that we can't control, you know, off the pitch and transfer market and all that kind of stuff, will fade into the background if, you know, we win games on a regular basis. Simple as that. So, yeah. It's going to be very important indeed.
Yeah. I mean, they are, if you look at the Premier League form table over the last five rounds of fixtures, Wolves are third. They've won their last three. They, I think their other games were postponed, one of them against us at the Emirates Stadium. But yeah, they come into it in good shape. I think they're a very organised side. They've got an excellent goalkeeper. He's been brilliant this season, Jose Sarr. I think their central midfield of Moutinho and Neves continues to impress with its ability to kind of dominate the ball and use it effectively. They're very, very decent. And but all that said, I think a defeat, I think there would be, yeah, pitchforks would be out.
Recriminations.
I think the frustrations that people felt around deadline day, which have kind of had, or will have had about 10 days to subside, would certainly bubble up again. I think a point, I don't like saying I want Arsenal to win every game. I don't think a point at Wolves is a bad result in context at all. But we're at a stage of the season where every point is precious, and three points are especially so. And, you know, I mean, if Wolves keep going like they're going, then you have to call this a bit of a six-pointer, really. I mean, they're a team who, they'd be outsiders for a top six place, but they would consider themselves in contention.
For sure, for sure. And it's two games in 2 weeks against Wolves, because the home game has been rescheduled for the end of February.
Yeah, and listen, something I've felt all season long, December was a bit of an outlier in this, is that, you know, we're a much better side at home than we are away. And, you know, in a hostile atmosphere, we haven't always looked quite the same team. So it'll be interesting to see how we cope with that element of it as well. I'm certainly a lot more confident about the home fixture against them than I am the away one. But
yeah,
it will be really interesting, won't it, to see, you know, you mentioned that lack of sharpness. I mean, we're used to teams looking a bit rusty after an international break. I guess there the difference is, players are all sort of disparate and they haven't had a lot of time together. In theory, they've had more time together now than they'll get almost at any other point in the season to work on things.
Yeah.
And a friendly game at the weekend as well, I believe they played against Reading. They certainly were due to play. They should be in good nick coming into this one.
Yeah, we'll know how well it went on Friday if Mikel Arteta wheels out his brand new assistant manager, Brian Loophole.
Yeah, exactly.
Just to get away with it again. We might need him. Let me see. At Joy It Guha on Twitter, who's at Balochelle, apologies if I've mispronounced that, says, "Gully Monday morning. The next six fixtures for Arsenal are Wolves, Brentford, Wolves, Watford, Leicester, Aston Villa. What would be the minimum number of points you think we need to be in contention for a top four? And what do you think we will get? Like, what's a decent return from that run of fixtures?"
For top four, he's saying. Arsenal need a lot of points from those games to get top four. because there are tougher ones ahead.
Yeah.
I think I'm right in saying that we sort of statistically have harder fixtures in the second half of the season than we've had in the first. So six games he's asking about, right? Okay, Wolves away, Brentford at home, Wolves at home, Watford away, Leicester at home, Villa away. Villa don't look a bad side at the moment either. So I think they need to, if they're going to get top four, I think to get top four, they probably have to win five of those six.
So
certainly
that's
four.
15, yeah.
I'm only saying that because I think there are games ahead beyond that. You know, once we get beyond that, we start getting into Manchester United. We've got a game against Spurs to be rearranged. We've got a game against Chelsea somewhere that's got to be rearranged, I think. You know, there are fixtures where I wouldn't say expect us to drop points, but certainly fear we will drop points. That is a relatively kind run.
Mm.
Wolves and Villa away are not easy games. They're not gimmies, don't get me wrong. But I think we certainly need to win four. And it would be good if we could win five. What do you think?
I think that guy should turn off his bloody windblower.
I'll shut the shutter at least to try and dampen it.
Wow.
Yes, go on.
Yeah, I think we need to win. If we're going to get top four, we need to win five of those. Simple as that. Simple as that. That is a ridiculous noise, isn't it?
It is quite loud.
Is it louder than usual?
It doesn't. Well, we've sort of, by switching to 10:30, we've sort of largely evaded it, but he's obviously, you know, he's had a big weekend, started a shift late.
Dear. Okay.
Well, I can give it some time if you want. I can see if he stops, but I reckon it'll be 20 minutes, half an hour.
No, we got to crack on through, unfortunately. Hopefully he can just sort of fade away into the background a little bit for everybody, and we'll see what happens. But yeah, we got to win five of those for top four. I mean, I think if you come away with four wins, a couple of draws, you can't be unhappy either. And then you've got to look at, like you say, you've got to look at those games against the more difficult opposition, the likes of Spurs and Chelsea and Liverpool, Man United. Those games, you know, if you get something from those, then it becomes not quite a bonus, but it gives you maybe some of those games could well be six-pointers. The United one, the Spurs one, like we just said with the Wolves one. So,
yeah, and the thing is about this Arsenal team, one thing they've done relatively well, not well, but it's interesting, is that they haven't drawn that many games this season. In the past, we've drawn loads and loads. We've only drawn three times this year. So although we've lost seven games, the fact that we've converted a lot of potential draws into wins means that we're in a decent enough spot. And 3 points are so valuable. You know, there's such a prize for getting the results with the 3 points that we've got to go for those. So yeah, at least four, probably five, if we're serious about the Champions League.
Yeah. Okay. Is it my question or your question?
It's probably mine, actually. I've got some questions that are sort of a little bit away from the Arsenal men's first team path. So Simon here on the Discord said, morning, guys. Just wondered on your thoughts on Vivian Miedemar. Is she the perfect forward? That pass for the equaliser on the weekend, was Bergkamp at his best?
Holy moly. It was a brilliant pass, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, what a ball that was. Is she the perfect forward? I mean, maybe. But, yeah, the vision and the execution of that pass was just unbelievable. I saw people talking about it on Twitter. I hadn't seen it. And then I was going, well, wow, I was expecting like a threaded kind of through ball or something like that, but play it from as deep as she did between the United defenders into the path of the forward was just unbelievable. Unbelievable.
It's interesting, like, you know, she's talked about this many times, but because her goal scoring record is so good, she is sort of characterised sometimes as number nine, but I think she always sees herself as more of a 9.5 or a 10, someone who can play deeper. And I think it's because she's just got such a rounded game that she is capable of moments like that, even in deeper roles. What she has done, I think, for the women's team has been extraordinary, and I think her ability has kind of elevated the women's game in England. I think, I've never known a female footballer so talked about among sort of wider diaspora fans. I've absolutely loved watching her and intend to savour every moment of her in an Arsenal shirt.
Contract is up at the end of the season as well, isn't it? So
yeah. We'll enjoy it while you can.
Yeah, maybe so. Did you have another one there? You said you had a couple.
I did actually. What this was, was it on the Discord or was it on Twitter? Let me have a little look. This was about positions in football. I thought it was quite interesting. I just need to find it, which is why I'm doing this talking slowly. Arctic G. Wilo on the Discord says, "We have seen nearly all positions in the game change drastically, tactically, or in how it's played in the last 10 to 15 years or so. But what is the position that you think has changed the most? And secondly, what position has changed the least?"
I suppose the obvious one is goalkeeper when it comes to changing the most because of what you need or what teams want their goalkeepers to do with the ball at their feet now, you know? Mm-hmm. It used to be a case that, you know, you pass it back to your goalkeeper, you pick it up and away you go. And then goalkeepers had to play with their feet and most of them couldn't. And then it became like a safety option. Go back to the goalkeeper, goalkeeper lumps it and away you go again. But now you need the goalkeeper to be able to pass the ball and to be able to put it, you know, with precision in the path of certain players or into certain players and to evade, almost be like a defender in terms of how they evade the high press. So that seems like an obvious one. What's changed the least? That's a difficult one, I think.
Yeah, I think I was thinking about this and I would probably go for central midfield in some capacity. Only in that I feel like the demands on that position compared to some others have been relatively consistent. You know, there's always been a kind of all-round... Well, not always, but certainly in the last 20 years or so, there's always been an all-round element to it. And I think while the sort of athleticism has stepped up, I think that kind of the boxes you need to tick to play in that part of the pitch are relatively consistent.
I mean, the ability to be a two-way player, if you know what I mean, is still so important.
Because I think centre-forward... You know, goal scorer is always going to have a place in the game, but I do think the kind of defensive and sort of tactical component has changed quite a lot there with the advent, not the advent, but I guess the resurgence in pressing, you know, also slightly the combination play, I think, has become a little bit more detailed. Wingers, you know, that thing of sort of getting to the byline and slinging crosses in feels a little outdated now. You know, there's an expectation that you'll invert and go in field. Centre backs, I think the requirements on the ball were so different. We spoke not too long ago about Sol Campbell and how would he fare in the modern game with the ball at his feet. I think it would be really interesting to see how he'd handle that. And fullback, I think fullback, if you weren't going to go for goalkeeper, I think you could make a case for a position that's really changed and developed just in terms of the degree of influence they seem to exert on a game.
Do you think that's a general thing, though, or have there just been some fullbacks who have been so outstanding that they become, in the minds of people who watch, as like, well, that's how you have to play fullback, and that's what you have to be able to do from fullback, whereas, let's say, somebody like Dani Alves, for example, is just like an extraordinary player in that position who, you know, there aren't very many players who can do what Dani Alves does.
No, I do take that point, and I think Alves and, shall we say, the guys at Liverpool, I think are kind of outliers, I think, in terms of how excellent they are and their degree of productivity. But I still think that that has, in being such outliers, they have influenced, I think the development of the position, and I maybe this is unfair, but I feel like you used to be able to hide a player at fullback a bit.
I know what you're saying.
Those days are long gone. I don't think there are any passengers in a team these days, but I think partly the playing out from the back, the emphasis on that, and I just think what's expected of them going forward. But it's interesting, you know, you speak to some people and they'll say football hasn't changed that much. You know, there was an interesting quote from, who was it? Martin O'Neill at the weekend. Did you see this?
No.
Martin O'Neill said he went to a talk, a seminar that was given by Ralph Ranick, where Ranick sort of demonstrated his five principles of how to play the game. And Martin O'Neill sort of said, well, I learnt three of those on my first day in the job. And I don't know if it's just sort of, you know, some people
will
say...
He's a miserable prick, though.
Yeah, Martin O'Neill. Some people will say that. But, and you know, there might just be that kind of old man thing of, oh, in my day it was all the same.
4-4-2.
Yeah, but I do think there is, I do have some sympathy with coaches from a previous generation about that. I do think that the way in which we as fans and journalists and media discuss and analyse and are informed about tactics now means that we're sort of constantly reading new insights to it. But I think that means that we're sometimes guilty of thinking, well, that means there weren't tactics 30 years ago, which isn't the case at all, you know. Our football parlance has become so much more sophisticated that we're able to kind of unpick tactics in a way that we weren't. You know, something like pressing, for example. You know, Dave Bassett was doing that at Wimbledon in the 80s, but it was, you know, just not analysed in quite the same fashion.
Exactly. It's like John Aldridge, when he was playing for Ireland under Jack Charlton, running back and forth. I mean, it wasn't quite coordinated pressing, but it was putting pressure on the opponent high up the pitch. So they would, you know...
The principles have remained largely the same, but equally, I'm sure it is substantially more sophisticated at this point. And also, it's fashion as well. Like, you know, sometimes these things come and then they disappear. You know, there was a time when every team played with the kind of Claude Makélélé bloke sat in front of a back four, and then midfield has moved slightly away from that to be a little bit more two-way. You know, there are fashions in football that come and go and that alter as teams shift in style. So, yeah, who knows where we'll be. In 5 years' time, the keepers will be playing on the halfway line or something mental like that, probably.
Okay, here's a question from at Magic Vindaloo on Twitter, whose name is Sotiris Anastasiadis. Anastasiadis, I think. Okay. He says, hi, gents, long-time listener, blah, blah, blah. I love the clear the decks effort and buying young, but should we now look at a couple of experienced players? We don't need every player in the team to be a project. I think this is an interesting question.
I'm just to sort of, for the point of sort of, you know, having a strong opinion, I'm going to say no. I'm going to say we shouldn't go for players over the age of kind of 25, 26. I think that we've just been burnt so many times by buying players whose market value diminishes during their time with us that as a fan, I just don't really want to do it anymore. You know, like, for example, these components that we're looking for, centre forward, centre midfield, I don't think we have to stick rigidly to the under 23 thing. I think if they're 24, 25, that's fine. But once they get to kind of 27, 28, I don't think we should be doing that at this point in the project and at this point in our development. So I'm going to say no. What about you?
I'm pretty much aligned with that, but I do think that sometimes you might be presented with an opportunity to add some ready-made, fully developed talent to your team, which can help you take a step forward. I don't think we should be completely closed to the idea of signing a player because he's at an age where we're going to end up in a situation like, for example, the Lacazette situation, where we buy a guy who's 25. By the time he leaves at the end of his five-year contract, he's 30. Nobody wants to buy him. The transfer market is what it is, et cetera, et cetera. But it doesn't mean that what that player gives you in terms of value for money, if they can produce on the pitch, isn't something we should consider. So I think broadly, I agree with you. I think if we're going to spend big money on a striker, it should be a 22-year-old, 23-year-old, who, even if he doesn't make it at 26, if we try and sell him, you know, we can get some money back for him. Whereas, you know, which is the situation I think we're in with Pepe this summer. You know, he's going to be 26. He is 26, whatever age. You know, he's still got good years ahead of him, and at 2 years left on his contract, we're never going to get back what we paid for him, but we should get something if we decide to sell, right? So that's where I think the money should be spent. But if there is the opportunity to add ready-made talent to your squad that can instantly improve your team, you cannot be closed off to that, even if you have been burned. That's just the nature of the way football works at the moment. Or maybe we're going to have a situation, James, where players get to a kind of midpoint of their career and let their contracts run down as well. Do you know what I mean? It's all these players who are 30 heading towards the end of their contracts, running their contracts down. But maybe now the way to get a move isn't necessarily going to be a transfer, because teams are not going to want to spend money on 25, 26-year-olds who are going to be 30 by the time they leave, because they know they're not going to be able to keep them for the duration of their contract. They're going to have to sell them at 28, whatever it might be. So maybe there's a case that you'll see players, you know, who are looking at their contractual situations, who are going to say, I will sign a contract and I'll see that contract out till I'm 25, 26, and then I've got the options. I can stay with my club if they want me, or I'm available on the market for free. So,
yeah, that would be an interesting development. I think you make a really good point. I mean, granted, it's not a deal that worked out particularly well, but Liverpool are often praised for their smart thinking in the transfer market. But when an opportunity came up to sign Thiago at 29, they didn't hesitate because they felt he could provide an immediate injection of quality. I guess once you've undertaken the kind of big rebuild and regeneration of the squad that we had to do and are in the process of doing, adding someone who's a bit more experienced begins to make a bit more sense. I think the problem was we were doing that on a squad that was already aging. But when you have kind of completely renovated it, one or two here and there wouldn't hurt. I mean, it's funny, you know, I hesitate to say this, but I almost wonder if there might be value if Arsenal do lose Lacazette. They will have just lost, and having lost Aubameyang as well, they might lose Bern Leno. They will have lost so much seniority and experience within the squad. I do wonder if there's a place for almost a kind of, and bear with me on this, but a kind of Stefan Lichtsteinery type of signing.
Yeah.
Just someone who is like an experienced squad player who's been there and done that and can be a bit of a role model for players. Not necessarily someone who's going to play every week, but who, you know, sets the right example and just has the benefit of having been in these kind of situations before and can share that with such a young group. I've got no idea who that would be. And hopefully it'll be someone who would perform better than Lichtsteiner did in his time at Arsenal. But yeah, it wouldn't be a crazy piece of thinking.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I do think maybe a 35-year-old is going too far the other way.
I
think there is some benefit to experience, but quality will always trump that. Here's a question from Richard O'Grady, who's at RichardO'Grady85 on Twitter. And he says, goodly morning, gents. How concerned are you over the Saka contract rumours? And also, if we miss out on top six, do you think Mikel Arteta's time is up? Actually, I didn't want to ask that one. I wanted to ask the one about Saka. I thought it was related to that. So Saka contract rumours, talk of him being offered a new deal, but also reported interest from Liverpool and Manchester City.
Well, can we be surprised by that? You know, he's one of the best young players in the country. He had a fantastic Euros as well. We forget, last summer. So I doubt it's only clubs in England looking at Bukayo Saka. I'm sure clubs like Bayern Munich, Real Madrid, Paris Saint-Germain, I'm sure he's on all of their radars. If he wasn't, they wouldn't be doing their jobs, because he's brilliant. And am I worried about the contract situation? A little bit only in that, you know, he's got an agent that we've not always been able to swiftly do deals with. Mm-hmm. There have been some protracted negotiations. I'm thinking of cases like Balogun. I mean, Eddie's slightly different, but there have been one or two others, I mean, that, you know, have not always progressed as smoothly as maybe the club would like. But, and I'm sure the agent in question would say, well, they haven't made the right offers. So, I'm sure there's two sides to that story. But it's not something that's keeping me up at night at this point. I just think Saka's, he seems happy, he's doing well. I'm not preoccupied by it. Maybe I should be, but I'm not. Are you?
Well, look, I think I prefer a situation where we have a player so good that everybody wants him, rather than players who are so average nobody does, you know? Mm-hmm. That's, to me, a better situation for Arsenal to be in, because you go places with those players. You know, you can end up making progress with players like that, whereas you can't really with the other kind. I think this is very much tied into how much progress we make as a team, as a club as well, you know? If it feels like we can compete properly, if it feels like we can win things, and I don't just mean the occasional cup, I mean if we can challenge, if we're back in Europe, I think our job of tying him down to a new contract becomes a lot easier. A lot easier, mm-hmm. you know? He's grown up the club, and I'm sure that if he felt he could win the things his talent should win, or, you know, at least be involved in, then he'll stay. I don't think we'll have a difficult job in convincing him to stay. Mm-hmm. But as we've seen, like, I think the Jack Grealish thing is a really good example. You know, a Villa boy, grew up at the club, loves Aston Villa, but at the end of the day was too good for them. You know, his talent was such that for him to achieve what he felt like he wanted to achieve from the game, he'd move. And that's what I think Saka will do, and any Arsenal player will do, unless we can make this team competitive. So that falls then, of course, on, you know, the manager and the executives and the owners and all of that kind of stuff. So it's, for me, it's impossible to separate the contract situation from our own progress. You know?
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, what the Grealish situation also shows is that if Man City decide they really want a player, they are prepared to go to quite extraordinary lengths to get them. I mean, 100 million was a lot of money to pay for Jack Grealish by any measure. And it would be difficult. It would be difficult if they came after Saka with the same degree of commitment. We'll cross that bridge when we get to it. Like you say, what we achieve between now and the end of the season could be instrumental in persuading him that his future, for now at least, remains at the Emirates Stadium. Okay, what about this? There have been some number of penalty shootouts this weekend in the AFCON final, and Manchester United somewhat enjoyably going out to Middlesbrough in the FA Cup. Cartoon Steve Bold at Cartoon Boldy says, who are your all-time top five Arsenal penalty takers and the order you'd have them take them in?
Oh, the order?
Yeah.
Oh. This is a good one.
Yeah, I'd go Van Persie number one. You know, Salah didn't take in the final for AFCON because he was number five, and I just think that's ludicrous.
Yeah, I agree.
you got to get a couple of your good takers out really early doors. And I would start with Van Persie.
I think he was a superb penalty taker, no question. He would definitely be in my top five. Ian Wright?
Yeah. I'd have Thierry Henry.
Lauren?
Lauren's my fifth, I think.
Lauren's your roll it down the middle.
Yeah. Exactly. Nerves of steel.
And I know, like, the sample size is very small, but, like, in terms of just sheer enjoyment from penalties, Maitland-Niles' penalty kicks during his time at Arsenal have been superb.
Very good fun.
Yeah. But, I remember watching the penalty shootout at Manchester United recently in the 2005 FA Cup.
Yeah.
Ashley Cole took a very good penalty.
Yeah.
Freddie Ljungberg took a very good penalty. Van Persie takes a great penalty. Van Persie, Wright, Henry, Lauren, Dixon.
Could go Dixon.
Scored a good few.
I would go Van Persie. Yeah, Van Persie. I think my order would be Van Persie. I think I'd then go Henry, then Wright. Lauren fifth for me. Fourth. Who do I fancy? I might go Lacazette,
How many has he taken for Arsenal? He has scored quite a few on it.
He's taken a few, but his record across his career is very good. I mean, he was, infamous for scoring lots of penalties at Lyon, inflating his goal stats substantially. I think he's pretty good in those situations, so maybe him. But Maitland-Niles is a shout. Lee Dixon is a shout. Ashley Cole was very good. He took penalties for England as well in shootouts, Ashley Cole, and scored in pressurised scenarios.
Penalty goals. I'm looking up Lacazette here. 32 scored, 6 missed. Only 1 missed for Arsenal.
I'm going to stick with him. But yeah, there's a few names. Would you go Maitland-Niles just for the sort of the fun factor?
Yeah. Why not? It's penalty shootout. The others have scored. We know they've scored because they're great. And, it's the Champions League final against, I don't know, Man City, somebody like that. That'd be amazing. And up strolls Maitland-Niles. Did you see the Bill Murray golf shot this weekend? I think he was playing in some kind of pro-am.
No.
And he rolled a putt past the hole, walked past it, stood there, looked in the air, and hit it back about 5 feet with the back of his putter straight into the hole. Cool as you like. Maitland-Niles can score the penalty equivalent of that putt, I think. Don't know how he would do it. He would stroll up, goalkeeper, wait for the goalkeeper to commit, then lie down on his side like it's a beautiful sunny day, and he'd just knock it into the back of the net, roll it in.
The birdcatcher.
Yeah.
Sure.
Exactly. All right. Look, we will leave it there, I think, for this particular episode. That silence was beautiful, wasn't it, when that guy stopped?
Oh, it was worth doing the podcast just for that silence.
Oh, did you ever, like, you're in the kitchen or something like that and the radio's on and there's a song on and it's just, whatever it is, it's the wrong song. And you turn the radio off and that 2 seconds of silence is just the most beautiful thing in the world. Apologies for the background noise on that one, folks. Not much we could do about it. But as ever, thank you very much indeed for being here. We do have football this week, so we'll be doing a preview podcast over on Patreon. Join us for that. And we'll have a podcast on Friday morning as well. Won't be with James because you will be in Ireland.
I'll be in Ireland, to be sure.
There's more to Ireland than this.
Well, I'll find out.
You will.
Back.
You will. Please do. We'll talk to you next week. As ever, thanks a million for listening, and we'll catch you on the next one.
Bye-bye. We'll
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.